we didn't anticipate the amount of books that it was going to be returned. So you got to imagine a big laundry, it's like a big laundry bin, but it's like three times big as that, full of books. By the end of the third day, there was like about 10 tubs.
That's Juana Flores, the children's librarian at Kings Highway.
Her branch was one of the first six locations in Brooklyn to reopen for lobby service back in July. And from the very first few days, it was clear that many, many people in Brooklyn really wanted to give us their books back. Enough people to fill 10 tubs of books, and we did a rough measurement on those tubs. They're like 3 feet square by 3 feet deep. So it's a lot of books.
And it wasn't just getting their books out of their apartments that people were excited about. Here's Dennis Stewart, the branch manager at Kings Highway Library.
The thing that really jumped out at me was like our return bin, right? As soon as you come in the door, you could put them in, but people just, in that short time, they make sure they say hi and they make sure they say bye and smile. It's just like people are so happy to like interact with library staff again.
We have a lot of phone calls and they're always sending is like, when is the library going to be open fully? And that's like the number one question they ask.
Along with the rest of New York City and the country, we're slowly opening our doors again. And it's a balance. Our desire to provide service to our community with the need to keep everyone safe and healthy. And yes, Brooklyn, you can physically borrow our books again. I went to Bay Ridge Library the other day to hear what patrons think about being able to come back to their local library.
So what brings you back to the branch today?
The wonderful selection of books and the fact that we are able to use the materials, for my child to enhance her reading. We used to go and participate in some of the arts and stuff that they used to do throughout her childhood. She's 9 now. I am a mother of 8 kids, so the library was always a fun and interactive way of me teaching them not only about life, but also about culture.
What do I miss about the library in the before time, in the long ago? Yeah. The idea of going through the stacks, and just like more often than not, I would come here like, oh, hey, I heard about this book. I want to check it out. And then I would go where it is, and it'd be 3-4 others on the stack that also looked interesting, jumped out at me.
That was Yvonne Casillas and Michael Toomey on their way to drop off books and pick up new books at Bay Ridge Library.
For those of us staff who are going back to branches, we can see just how much we matter to the public because even though it's limited lobby service, the sheer amount of books coming in and out can be overwhelming at times. And we are getting questions about what the library will look like in a few months, in a few weeks, in a few hours.
And the truth is, we have no idea. We are wondering, along with all of you, what are public spaces, the places we used to gather and learn and talk in close quarters, what are they going to look like? We asked that question of Eric Kleinenberg when we interviewed him a few weeks ago. Eric is a social science professor and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU. He's the author of several books, most recently Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And we asked him if the pandemic has changed the way he thinks about public libraries.
I mean, I don't know if the pandemic has changed the way that I think about them. It's just, it makes me all the more convinced that we need gathering places and we need places that are public and accessible, democratic. And when we walk into a library, we feel the sense that like, oh, we're citizens of a place that invests in us and offers us these resources. I feel like we need that more than ever. The thing I keep thinking about during the pandemic is that if we're going to try to build back and, you know, invest in infrastructure and create some better way of living after this is over, we can't just build back, you know, airports and highways and tunnels like we used to have them. We need to kind of think about a new way of organizing ourselves. And I don't see how we do it without libraries featuring more prominently than ever.
Today on Borrowed, we're going to dig into the challenges of reopening our libraries starting with a call to reimagine what we use our buildings for.
And we're going to talk to LA County Library System about additional challenges that their community is facing as they reopen. We are going to get into all of it on Borrowed. I'm Krissa Corbett-Kavoris.
And I'm Adra Aduse. You're listening to Stories That Start at the Library.
I want to return to the conversation we had with Eric Kleinenberg a few weeks ago. We talked about a lot of things, and honestly, a lot of it was a call to action. We're hoping that libraries can be even more vital and even more democratic during this moment of crisis. And Eric had a lot of ideas about that.
We started by reading a passage from the first chapter of Palaces for the People that described a scene at our very own New Lots Library in East New York, Brooklyn. Eric visited one of our popular programs for seniors, Library Lanes, which brought older adults together to play Wii Bowling at the library.
And it's an amazing thing, Library Lanes, because you get these groups of seniors who have every reason to be home and alone and to feel isolated or lonely, and who are in that situation right now because of the pandemic. And basically, every week during ordinary times, seniors all over Brooklyn can go to their branch library on a morning and they compete against other branches through an Xbox. And it's this awesome social collective experience, which is like physical and competitive and connected. Like just people are with each other in this amazing way. And I got these photographs and some are in the book, but not a lot of them, but you just can see these smiles on the faces of the participants. And it's the smile that you get when you are happy with other people, it's a very specific kind of expression. And it's painful to think about all the people who can't have that experience right now because we're basically all locked up in our homes.
In the book, which of course Palaces for the People, it is a reference to Andrew Carnegie, who called them that, who referred to public libraries as palaces for the people. But, your book is about social infrastructure in general, which you're defining as the physical spaces and organizations that have an impact on how we interact. And this has been really, anxiety inducing for us as a library because those physical spaces have been closed for so long. And even as we tentatively take these reopening steps, there's this huge anxiety about gathering, which gathering used to be an unalloyed good, and now it's really mitigated. So how do you see that new social infrastructure emerging, maybe bigger than libraries? Like, where do you see a little bit of cause for hope, if at all, after this or during this?
Well, I mean, first of all, I guess let's acknowledge that we're in this real turning point in history. But in November, we're either going to have an opportunity, a kind of once in a lifetime opportunity to have something like a Green New Deal, right? Like a new investment in ourselves and in the systems that we rely on to, operate in a democratic society for the 21st century, or we're going to be, I hate to say it, in a totally new dark age and much bleaker than the one we're in right now. We have a once in a lifetime opportunity to hit a hard reset. And that involves, changing our approach to the pandemic, but also it involves changing our approach to climate change and to urban planning and to social infrastructure. I can't stop thinking about how, especially in the void created by the crisis created by the postal system, like how can libraries, including branch libraries, get supercharged to help people vote?
Yeah.
Can libraries be places where you can do absentee voting and, file your ballot? I mean, our libraries are already registering to vote. They are doing the census. In many cities, you can actually vote at the library. This is my new thing, is like sounding the alarm and trying to rally my like library superhero friends to get libraries totally engaged on this right now, like in the next week. What can we do to get libraries to be places where people can go and file absentee ballots? I mean, my God, it's such a nonpartisan issue, right? Voting.
Yeah.
We're basically talking about how libraries can be used to promote democracy and civic engagement even more than they have been. And I don't see how we can miss this opportunity. But it means, like the national library leadership and local library leadership getting, really invested at this very moment. And, libraries aren't used to operating on this kind of issue in this way. but I don't see how they cannot.
That's true. I mean, you're helping us sort of fill the void in terms of an identity crisis, right? We are a place of social gatherings, but we can't really socially gather physically. So that that's an idea that I think, we should be repeating and calling to action as often as we can.
That sounded alarm.
Yeah. So Eric, you're working on a new book about COVID-19. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it's early days, but it's tentatively called 2020, a social autopsy. And it's about, because right at the end of this year, all we're going to want to do is go back to 2020 and remember these good times. I'm writing it because I think this is the most consequential year of our lives. Mm-hmm. I've never lived through any moment like this where it just feels like everything is up for grabs and everything is on the line. And as of this moment, late August, almost September, 2020, I have no idea where we're going to wind up. I mean, I don't know. And the book is kind of full of social research about the pandemic and the way that it's played out in different places for different groups. And, that New York City has been the epicenter of this global crisis. And I think it's really important for us to, find a way to register and record our experiences. And so could I just say, while you still got me, if anybody's listening and doesn't know about the Brooklyn Public Library or Queens Public Library's really exciting efforts to generate an oral history archive, please go to the website and volunteer and either give your own story, provide your own story, or help do interviews that can help us build an archive so we can make sense of this moment, because it's a very consequential thing we're going through. And this is one of the great things that libraries can do, is help us, figure out who we are and what we've been through.
Well, I look forward to reading about it when 2020 is not as painfully happening to all of us.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Yeah, thank you.
My God, we're done. I feel like... Do you feel depressed? Do you feel uplifted?
No, I feel more uplifted than depressed. So it's a gain. It's a net gain.
Okay, so even though we hit some dark themes today,
you got to start low and then you go high, right? Yeah.
That oral history project that Eric mentioned is our Brooklyn COVID-19 Stories project, which is part of our ongoing local oral history archive, Our Streets, Our Stories, a project that was started in 2013. We're looking for Brooklynites across the spectrum of experience, from caregivers to teenagers, older adults and teachers. If you have got a story to share about your experience with COVID-19, or you know someone whose story should be represented in the archive, email ososproject@bklynlibrary.org.
We'll put links on our show notes page so you can read more information about the project and visit our interactive map of Brooklyn, where you can listen to the stories that we've already collected. That'll be at bklynlibrary.org/podcast.
If you are looking for another podcast to try out, we would like to recommend Writ Large, which is a great podcast about how books change the world. Obviously, as a library, we think that's true. In every episode, the host, Zachary Davis, talks with leading scholars about one book that shaped the world we live in, whether you've heard of it or not. These conversations look beyond plot summaries, and they tell the stories behind the story. Subscribe now wherever you listen to podcasts, or download the Lyceum podcast app to hear exclusive bonus episodes. That's LYCEUM.
So we just heard an interview with Eric Kleinenberg about some big ideas, about how libraries can come back from this crisis bigger and better than before. And we wanted to check in with another library system to see how they were handling the reopening process.
These are some of the most professionally challenging times I think that any of us have had to live through, frankly.
That's Sky Patrick, the director of the LA County Library.
So we're dealing, obviously, with the pandemic. We have it here in California, we have fires on the East Coast. They have hurricanes. There are a few tornadoes in the Midwest and the Tennessee area.
On top of a pandemic, many areas of the country are also dealing with severe weather. Much of California, Washington State, and Oregon are dealing with active fires that are threatening homes and businesses up and down the West Coast. Several LA County Library branches have had to close again because of the fires.
The LA County Library has not yet opened to the public for things like book browsing, though they do have sidewalk service, much like BPL, where you can pick up and drop off holds. But they did have to open their doors again for another emergency situation.
We get intense amounts of heat, and the libraries have opened in these last 7 months on several occasions as cooling centers. Last weekend, it was up to 111 degrees, if you can imagine. And so obviously this is a big public health issue in addition to the fires, in addition to the pandemic. So with that, we've had to partition off our community rooms, keep the doors locked so that we can support people during these harsh weather times.
And while most of their doors remain closed, LA County Library staff have been working in other institutions as well.
We have almost 250 staff serving as contact tracers. We have roughly 40 answering small business calls. We have people passing out food with the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. And we have some of our staff in hospitals actually serving as childcare providers for the frontline staff.
And, you know, this isn't necessarily what anyone expected their job would be as a library worker. And now they're these everyday heroes on the front lines of so many different challenges. So our hearts go out to our colleagues on the West Coast right now.
We asked Guy another question, the same one we posed to Eric. Will libraries change after this crisis is over?
Like Eric, Sky knows that in order for us to rebuild and reopen our society, libraries are going to play a bigger role than ever before. If anything, our many crises of 2020 have revealed more starkly the inequities that have always existed in our communities.
I think what this time has shown people, this concept of the digital divide. We've moved so many of our services online, but the truth still remains that our buildings are important via after-school care. The elderly, many of the elderly have no community outside of the library. I mean, there are ways in which I think we can still help. And once we open, I think it'll become very clear that the library will thrive again in our buildings.
In the meantime, until we can fully reopen, LA County Library and Brooklyn Public Library are both doing what we can to close the digital divide, that huge gap between people who have access to computers and internet and those who don't.
LA County just added 700 hotspots to their materials to be checked out. And at BPL, we have about 300 hotspots that have been out on loan to families since last year who need internet connection for school or work. We know that while our branches were shut, people logged onto our Wi-Fi 185,000 times from April through August.
This road to reopening, it's going to have its ups and downs. But one thing we know is that we are going to be changing right alongside with the times.
At this point, we're all still trying to figure out what the next step is. And the primary goal is to keep our customers and our staff safe, to keep people at home to the degree that they can stay home, and then try to support parents. I'm a parent. I'm at home today. This is hard. It's complicated. There's just literally nothing like it. And so the library is doing its best to fill the gaps where we can.
But before we can do that, before we can fill all the gaps, you know, be the virtual bowling alleys of 2019, or as Eric suggested, help with voting, we have to make sure we're safe for people to come into our doors.
Safety and health is something that our staff are concerned about for themselves, for their colleagues, but also for our patrons. Here's Juana again, who talked about being inundated with books those first few days when King's Highway Library reopened.
I was full of anxiety. Imagine being at home for 3 months. The COVID-19, I was concerned about it attaching to surfaces and books. So the patient can see the amount of books that we had to contend with, but they don't know the background. I mean, they don't know that we had to quarantine it.
So what Juana's talking about, that's a safety precaution we're taking at all of our branches across Brooklyn and New York City. When you bring your books back to us, the books go into quarantine. Here's how Dennis described it.
So once people return the books, they will be in the bin. And once the bin is filled, we'll take it to the quarantine area. And as soon as we put it in the quarantine area, we'll take a sign and put on there the time that they were returned and the date. After 4 days or 96 hours, then we will check them in.
So that's why your books might take longer than they used to get to you. On top of all of the extra time the books are taking to be checked in, BPL has moved to a new schedule for staff so that only half the staff are in the branch at any given time. Staff are split up into these A and B teams so that we have a lower density of people in the branch at any given time, which helps us with distancing.
These extra precautions sometimes affect what we can offer to you. We're taking care of our staff and taking care of you, so that might mean the branch has to delay their opening or sometimes close early.
In order to follow these ever-evolving scientific protocols, we consulted a research project that was started specifically to investigate how museums and libraries can safely reopen.
Hi, so I'm Nate Hill, the executive director of the Metropolitan New York Library Council.
Nate is the coordinator for the operations working group within REALM, which stands for Reopening Archives, Libraries, and Museums.
The REALM project is testing the lifespan of the coronavirus on actual slices of library books.
Some of the materials have been donated from libraries that we know, because you want to have not like a crisp, clean book, but you want like a book that actually is similar to what's going on in the real world, right? That has been, you know, people have grabbed it and reshelved it and such.
Based on the findings of the REALM project, BPL decided a few weeks ago that 96 hours was the safe amount of time to leave books in their bins, untouched in quarantine, before checking them in and getting them out to the next patron.
One consolation, perhaps, is that this isn't the first time in American history that we've had to figure out how to handle library books during a health crisis.
Yeah, that's right. According to research librarians in Carthage, Illinois, libraries closed several times for weeks or even months between 1910 and 1919, first for scarlet fever and then for the influenza epidemic.
I believe that I read that some books were even burned, which is pretty dramatic.
At least we aren't burning your library books. We're just having them hang out in bins for a little while.
If you are interested in the intersection between archiving and abolition, you should listen to Interference Archives' newest audio interference podcast series that speaks with the grassroots abolitionist group Survived and Punished. That group is fighting to end the criminalization of survivors of domestic violence. In the series, you'll hear voices from the inside and learn about the importance of documenting inside-outside organizing. That's Audio Interference, a podcast from Interference Archive. It would not be a borrowed episode without a book match segment. Our producer, Virginia, talked with Mariah McGrath, who put together a list of book recommendations to help you get through uncertain times.
So the first book I wanted to talk about is The Sweet Spot, and it's a lot about balance. The woman who wrote it is Dr. Christine Carter, and she's a sociologist and senior fellow at UC Berkeley. The reason I like The Sweet Spot is that it stresses the idea that if you go too far in any one direction, you become very inefficient. If you pull an all-nighter, for example, or if you're, you know, at your desk trying hard to come up with ideas or to come up with solutions, you really need time away. You need to give your brain a chance to turn things over. You need to give yourself and your brain some time to relax.
That sounds great. And what's the next book you want to tell us about?
So veering into school and how to help your kids put habits into place, Anna Homayoun, she has sort of two different books. One is That Crumpled Paper Was Due Last Week, and that is mostly aimed at boys and especially disorganized boys, so I jumped on that. And then there's sort of the counterpart is The Myth of the Perfect Girl, which is more about high-achieving girls and the pitfalls that they can fall into. And because her background is executive functioning coaching, she drills really deeply down into, you know, get a binder for each class. that's not necessarily the most helpful part of the book. What is she describes the different ways that students can lose their way, that they can see themselves, and how to sort of break free of that and find success in an easy way.
Well, thank you so much, Mariah. I can't wait to check out a few of these. And listeners can find The Sweet Spot by Christine Carter, as well as Anna Homayoun's books at Brooklyn Public Library. And we have all of those on a book match list, including more titles for you to check out. Thank you so much, Mariah.
Thank you, Virginia.
BARD is brought to you by Brooklyn Public Library and is hosted by me, Adwa Aduse, and Krissa Corbett-Cavoras. You can find a transcript of this episode at our website, bklynlibrary.org/podcast.
Borrowed is produced by Virginia Marshall and written by Virginia Marshall and Adwa Aduse, with help from Pritzi Bodenheimer, Jennifer Prophet, Meryl Friedman, and Robin Lester Kenton. Our music composer is Billy Libby.
Borrowed will be back in a few weeks. In the meantime, we promise to not burn your books.